You will, of course, forgive me my comparison. I can't boast of eloquence. But I will take as an example any point in the prosecutor's speech. The prisoner, running away in the garden in the dark, climbed over the fence, was seized by the servant and knocked him down with a brass pestle. Then he jumped back into the garden and spent 5 minutes over the man, trying to discover whether he'd killed him or not. And the prosecutor refuses to believe the prisoner's statement that he ran to old Gregory out of pity. No, he says. Such sensibility is impossible at such a moment. That's unnatural. He ran to find out whether the only witness of his crime was dead or alive, and so showed that he'd committed the murder, since he would not have run back for any other reason. Here you have psychology. But let us take the same method and apply it to the case the other way round, and our result would be no less probable. The murderer, we are told, leapt down to find out, as a precaution, whether the witness was alive or not. Yet he had left in his murdered father's study, as the prosecutor himself argues, an amazing piece of evidence in the shape of a torn envelope, with an inscription that there had been 3,000 rubles in it. If he had carried that envelope away with him, no one in the world would have known of that envelope and of the notes in it, and that the money had been stolen by the prisoner. Those are the prosecutor's own words. So on one side you see a complete absence of precaution. A man who has lost his head and run away in a fright, leaving that clue on the floor, and 2 minutes later, when he has killed another man, we are entitled to assume the most heartless and calculating foresight in him. But even admitting this was so, it is psychological subtlety, I suppose, that discerns that under certain circumstances I become as bloodthirsty and keen-sighted as a Caucasian eagle, while at the next I am as timid and blind as a mole. But if I am so bloodthirsty and cruelly calculating that when I kill a man I only run back to find out whether he's alive to witness against me, why should I spend 5 minutes looking after my victim at the risk of encountering other witnesses? Why soak my handkerchief, wiping the blood off his head so that it may be evidence against me later? If he was so cold-hearted and calculating, why not hit the servant on the head again and again with the same pestle so as to kill him outright and relieve himself of all anxiety about the witness? Again, though he ran to see whether the witness was alive, he left another witness on the path, that brass pestle which he'd taken from the two women and which they could always recognize afterwards as theirs, and prove that he'd taken it from them. And it is not as though he'd forgotten it on the path, dropped it through carelessness or haste. No, he'd flung away his weapon, for it was found 15 paces from where Grigory lay. Why did he do so? Just because he was grieved at having killed a man, an old servant, and he flung away the pestle with a curse as a murderous weapon. That's how it must have been. What other reason could he have had for throwing it so far? And if he was capable of feeling grief and pity at having killed a man, it shows that he was innocent of his father's murder. Had he murdered him, he would never have run to another victim out of pity. Then he would have felt differently. His thoughts would have been centred on self-preservation. He would have had none to spare for pity. That is beyond doubt. On the contrary, he would have broken his skull instead of spending 5 minutes looking after him. There was room for pity and good feeling just because his conscience had been clear till then. Here we have a different psychology. I have purposely resorted to this method, gentlemen of the jury, to show that you can prove anything by it. It all depends on who makes use of it. Psychology lures even most serious people into romancing, and quite unconsciously I am speaking of the abuse of psychology, gentlemen. Sounds of approval and laughter, at the expense of the prosecutor, were again audible in the court. I will not repeat the speech in detail. I will only quote some passages from it, some leading points. Chapter 11. There was no money, there was no robbery. There was one point that struck everyone in Fetyukovich's speech. He flatly denied the existence of the fatal 3,000 rubles, and consequently the possibility of their having been stolen. "Gentlemen of the jury," he began, "every new and unprejudiced observer must be struck by a characteristic peculiarity in the present case, namely the charge of robbery and the complete impossibility of proving that there was anything to be stolen. We are told that money was stolen, 3,000 rubles, but whether those roubles ever existed, nobody knows. Consider, how have we heard of that sum, and who has seen the notes? The only person who saw them and stated that they had been put in the envelope was the servant Smerdyakov. He had spoken of it to the prisoner and his brother, Ivan Fyodorovich, before the catastrophe. Madame Sviatlov, too, had been told of it. But not one of these three persons had actually seen the notes. No one but Smerdyakov had seen them. Here the question arises, if it's true they did exist, and that Smerdyakov had seen them, when did he see them for the last time? What if his master had taken the notes from under his bed and put them back in his cash box without telling him? Note that according to Smerdyakov's story, the notes were kept under the mattress. The prisoner must have pulled them out, and yet the bed was absolutely unrumpled. That is carefully recorded in the protocol. How could the prisoner have found the notes without disturbing the bed? How could he have helped soiling with his blood-stained hands the fine and spotless linen with which the bed had been purposely made? But I shall be asked, what about the envelope on the floor? Yes, it's worth saying a word or two about that envelope. I was somewhat surprised just now to hear the highly talented prosecutor declare of himself, observe, that but for that envelope, but for its being left on the floor, no one in the world would have known of the existence of that envelope and the notes in it, and therefore of the prisoner's having stolen it. And so that torn scrap of paper is, by the prosecution's own admission, the sole proof on which the charge of robbery rests. Otherwise, no one would have known of the robbery, nor perhaps even of the money. But is the mere fact that that scrap of paper was lying on the floor a proof that there was money in it, and that that money had been stolen? Yes, it will be objective. Smerdyakov had seen the money in the envelope. But when? When had he seen it for the last time, I ask you that? I talked to Smerdyakov, and he told me that he'd seen the notes 2 days before the catastrophe. Then why not imagine that old Fyodor Pavlovich, locked up alone in impatient and hysterical expectation of the object of his adoration, may have whiled away the time by breaking open the envelope and taking out the notes? What's the use of the envelope, he may have asked himself. She won't believe the notes are there, but when I show her the 30 rainbow-coloured notes in one roll, it will make more impression, you may be sure. It will make her mouth water. And so he tears open the envelope, takes out the money, and flings the envelope on the floor, conscious of being the owner and untroubled by any fears of leaving evidence. Listen, gentlemen, could anything be more likely than this theory and such an action? Why is that out of the question? But if anything of the sort could have taken place, the charge of robbery falls to the ground. If there was no money, there was no theft of it. If the envelope on the floor may be taken as evidence that there had been money in it, why may I not maintain the opposite? That the envelope was on the floor because the money had been taken from it by its owner. But I shall be asked what became of the money if Fyodor Pavlovich took it out of the envelope, since it was not found when the police searched the house. In the first place, part of the money was found in the cash box, and secondly, he might have taken it out that morning or the evening before, to make some other use of it, to give or send it away. He may have changed his idea, his plan of action, completely, without thinking it necessary to announce the fact to Smerdyakov beforehand. And if there is the barest possibility of such an explanation, how can the prisoner be so positively accused of having committed murder for the sake of robbery, and of having actually carried out that robbery? This is encroaching on the domain of romance. If it is maintained that something has been stolen, the thing must be produced, or at least its existence must be proved beyond doubt. Yet no one had ever seen these notes. Not long ago in Petersburg, a young man of 18, hardly more than a boy, who carried on a small business as a costermonger, went in broad daylight into a money changer's shop with an axe, and with extraordinary typical audacity killed the master of the shop and carried off 1,500 rubles. 5 hours later he was arrested, and except 15 rubles he had already managed to spend, the whole sum was found on him. Moreover, the shopman, on his return to the shop after the murder, informed the police not only of the exact sum stolen, but even of the notes and gold coins of which that sum was made up. And those very notes and coins were found on the criminal. This was followed by a full and genuine confession on the part of the murderer. That's what I call evidence, gentlemen of the jury. In that case, I know, I see, I touch the money, and cannot deny its existence. Is it the same in the present case? And yet it is a question of life and death. Yes, I shall be told. But he was carousing that night, squandering money he was shown to have had, 1,500 rubles. Where did he get the money? But the very fact that only 1,500 could be found, and the other half of the sum could nowhere be discovered, shows that that money was not the same, and had never been in any envelope. By strict calculation of time, it was proved at the preliminary inquiry, that the prisoner ran straight from those women servants to Perhotin's, without going home, and that he'd been nowhere. So, he'd been all the time in company, therefore could not have divided the 3,000 in half and hidden half in the town. It's just this consideration that has led the prosecutor to assume that the money is hidden in some crevice at Mokroe. Why not in the dungeons of the castle of Udolpho, gentlemen? Isn't this supposition really too fantastic and too romantic? And observe, if that supposition breaks down, the whole charge of robbery is scattered to the winds. For in that case, what could have become of the other 1,500 rubles? By what miracle could they have disappeared, since it's proved that the prisoner went nowhere else? And we are ready to ruin a man's life with such tales? I shall be told that he could not explain where he got the 1,500 that he had, and everyone knew that he was without money before that night. Who knew it, pray? The prisoner has made a clear and unflinching statement of the source of that money. And if you will have it so, gentlemen of the jury, nothing can be more probable than that statement, and more consistent with the temper and spirit of the prisoner. The prosecutor is charmed with his own romance. A man of weak will, who had brought himself to take the 3,000 so insultingly offered by his betrothed, could not, we are told, have set aside half and sewn it up, but would, even if he had done so, have unpicked it every 2 days and taken out 100, and so would have spent it all in a month. All this, you will remember, was put forward in a tone that brooked no contradiction. But what if the thing happened quite differently? What if you've been weaving a romance, and about quite a different kind of man? That's just it. You've invented quite a different man. I shall be told, perhaps, there are witnesses that he spent on one day all that 3,000 given him by his betrothed a month before the catastrophe, so he could not have divided the sum in half. But who are these witnesses? The value of their evidence has been shown in court already. Besides, in another man's hand, a crust always seems larger, and no one of these witnesses counted that money. That all judged simply at sight. And the witness Maximov has testified that the prisoner had 20,000 in his hand. You see, gentlemen of the jury, psychology is a two-edged weapon. Let me turn the other edge now, and see what comes of it. A month before the catastrophe, the prisoner was entrusted by Katerina Ivanovna with 3,000 rubles to send off by post. But the question is it true that they were entrusted to him in such an insulting and degrading way as was proclaimed just now? The first statement made by the young lady on the subject was different, perfectly different. In the second statement we heard only cries of resentment and revenge, cries of long-concealed hatred, and the very fact that the witness gave her first evidence incorrectly gives us a right to conclude that her second piece of evidence may have been incorrect also. The prosecutor will not, dare not, his own words, touch on that story. So be it. I will not touch on it either. But will only venture to observe that if a lofty and high-principled person, such as that highly respected young lady, unquestionably is, if such a person, I say, allows herself suddenly in court to contradict her first statement, with the obvious motive of ruining the prisoner, it is clear that this evidence has been given not impartially, not coolly. Have not we the right to assume that a revengeful woman might have exaggerated much? Yes, she may well have exaggerated in particular the insult and humiliation of her offering him the money. No, it was offered in such a way that it was possible to take it, especially for a man of so easy-going as the prisoner above all, as he expected to receive shortly from his father the 3,000 rubles that he reckoned was owing to him. It was unreflecting of him, but it was just his irresponsible want of reflection that made him so confident that his father would give him the money, that he would get it, and so could always dispatch the money entrusted to him and repay the debt. But the prosecutor refuses to allow that he could, the same day, have set aside half the money and sewn it up in a little bag. That's not his character, he tells us. He couldn't have had such feelings. But yet he talked himself of the broad Karamazov nature. He cried out about the two extremes which a Karamazov can contemplate at once. Karamazov is just such a two-sided nature, fluctuating between two extremes, that even when moved by the most violent craving for riotous gaiety, he can pull himself up if something strikes him on the other side. And on the other side is love, that new love which had flamed up in his heart. And for that love he needed money. Oh, far more than for carousing with his mistress. If she were to say to him, I am yours, I won't have Fyodor Pavlovich, then he must have money to take her away. That was more important than carousing. Could a Karamazov fail to understand it? That anxiety was just what he was suffering from. What is there improbable in his laying aside that money and concealing it in case of emergency? But time passed, and Fyodor Pavlovich did not give the prisoner the expected 3,000. On the contrary, the latter heard that he meant to use this sum to seduce the woman he, the prisoner, loved. If Fyodor Pavlovich doesn't give the money, he thought, I should be put in the position of a thief before Katerina Ivanovna. And then the idea presented itself to him that he would go to Katerina Ivanovna, lay before her the 1,500 roubles he still carried round his neck, and say, I am a scoundrel, but not a thief. So here we have already a twofold reason why he should guard that sum of money as the apple of his eye, why he shouldn't unpick the little bag and spend it 100 at a time. Why should you deny the prisoner a sense of honour? Yes, he has a sense of honour, granted that it's misplaced. Granted it's often mistaken, yet it exists and amounts to a passion, and he's proved that. But now the affair becomes even more complex. His jealous torments reach a climax, and those same two questions torture his fevered brain more and more. If I repay Katerina Ivanovna, where can I find the means to go off with Grushenka? If he behaved wildly, drank, and made disturbances in the taverns in the course of that month, it was, perhaps, because he was wretched and strained beyond his powers of endurance. These two questions became so acute that they drove him at last to despair. He sent his younger brother to beg for the last time for the 3,000 roubles, but without waiting for a reply, burst in himself and ended by beating the old man in the presence of witnesses. After that he had no prospect of getting it from anyone. His father would not give it him after that beating. The same evening, he struck himself on the breast, just on the upper part of the breast where that little bag was, and swore to his brother that he had the means of not being a scoundrel, but that still he would remain a scoundrel, for he foresaw that he would not use that means, that he wouldn't have the character, that he wouldn't have the willpower to do it. Why? Why does the prosecutor refuse to believe the evidence of Alexei Karamazov, given so genuinely and sincerely, so spontaneously and convincingly? And why, on the contrary, does he force me to believe in money hidden in a crevice in the dungeons of the castle of Udolpho? The same evening after his talk with his brother, the prisoner wrote that fatal letter, and that letter is the chief, the most stupendous proof of the prisoner having committed robbery. I shall beg from everyone, and if I don't get it, I shall murder my father and shall take the envelope with the pink ribbon on it from under his mattress as soon as Ivan has gone. A full program of the murder, we are told, so it must have been he. It has all been done as he wrote, cries the prosecutor. But in the first place, it's the letter of a drunken man, and written in great irritation. Secondly, he writes of the envelope, from what he has heard from Smerdyakov again, for he has not seen the envelope himself. And thirdly, he wrote it indeed, but how can you prove that he did it? Did the prisoner take the envelope from under the pillow? Did he find the money? Did that money exist, indeed? And was it to get the money that the prisoner ran off, if you remember? He ran off, post-haste, not to steal, but to find out where she was, the woman who had crushed him. He was not running to carry out a program, to carry out what he had written. That is, not for an act of premeditated robbery. But he ran, suddenly, spontaneously, in a jealous fury. Yes, I shall be told, but when he got there and murdered him, he seized the money too. But did he murder him after all? The charge of robbery I repudiate with indignation. A man cannot be accused of robbery if it's impossible to state accurately what he has stolen. That's an axiom. But did he murder him without robbery? Did he murder him at all? Is that proved? Isn't that, too, a romance?
Dmitri frowned painfully and looked with unutterable contempt at his father. I thought, he said in a soft and, as it were, controlled voice, that I was coming to my native place with the angel of my heart, my betrothed, to cherish his old age, and I find nothing but a depraved profligate, a despicable clown. A duel! Yelled the old wretch again, breathless and spluttering at each syllable. And you, Pyotr Alexandrovich Musov, let me tell you that there's never been in all your family a loftier and more honest, you hear, more honest woman than this creature, as you have dared to call her. And you, Dmitri Fyodorovich, have abandoned your betrothed for that creature, so you must yourself have thought that your betrothed couldn't hold a candle to her. That's the woman called a creature. Shameful, broke from Father Yosef. Shameful and disgraceful, Kalganov, flushing crimson, cried in a boyish voice, trembling with emotion. He had been silent till that moment. Why is such a man alive? Dmitri, beside himself with rage, growled in a hollow voice, hunching up his shoulders till he looked almost deformed. Tell me, can he be allowed to go on defiling the earth? He looked round at everyone and pointed at the old man. He spoke evenly and deliberately. Listen, listen, monks, to the parricide, cried Fyodor Pavlovich, rushing up to Father Yosef. That's the answer to your shameful. What is shameful? That creature, that woman of loose behavior, is perhaps holier than you are yourselves, you monks who are seeking salvation. She fell, perhaps in her youth, ruined by her environment, but she loved much, and Christ himself forgave the woman who loved much.
It was not for such love Christ forgave her, broke impatiently from the gentle Father Yosef.
Yes, it was for such, monks, it was. You save your souls here, eating cabbage, and think you are the righteous. You eat a gudgeon a day, and you think you bribe God with gudgeon.
This is unendurable, was heard on all sides in the cell. But this unseemly scene was cut short in a most unexpected way. Father Zosima rose suddenly from his seat, almost distracted with anxiety for the elder and everyone else. Alyosha succeeded, however, in supporting him by the arm. Father Zosima moved towards Dmitri and, reaching him, sank on his knees before him. Alyosha thought he'd fallen from weakness, but this was not so. The elder distinctly and deliberately bowed down at Dmitri's feet till his forehead touched the floor. Alyosha was so astounded that he failed to assist him when he got up again. There was a faint smile on his lips.
Goodbye. Forgive me, all of you, he said, bowing on all sides to his guests.
Dmitri stood for a few moments in amazement. Bowing down to him, what did it mean? Suddenly he cried aloud,
Oh God!
Hid his face in his hands and rushed out of the room. All the guests flocked out after him, in their confusion not saying goodbye or bowing to their host. Only the monks went up to him again for a blessing.
What did it mean, falling at his feet like that? Was it symbolic or what?
Said Fyodor Pavlovich, suddenly quieted and trying to reopen conversation without venturing to address anybody in particular. They were all passing out of the precincts of the hermitage at the moment.
I can't answer for a madhouse and for madmen, Musov answered at once ill-humouredly. But I will spare myself your company, Fyodor Pavlovich, and trust me for ever. Where's that monk?
That monk, that is, the monk who had invited them to dine with the superior, did not keep them waiting. He met them as soon as they came down the step from the elder's cell, as though he'd been waiting for them all the time.
Reverend Father, kindly do me a favour. Convey my deepest respect to the Father Superior. Apologise for me, personally, Musov, to his reverence, telling him that I deeply regret that owing to unforeseen circumstances I am unable to have the honour of being present at his table, greatly as I should desire to do so.
Musov said irritably to the monk.
And that unforeseen circumstance, of course, is myself.
Fyodor Pavlovich cut in immediately.
Do you hear, Father? This gentleman doesn't want to remain in my company, or else he'd come at once. And you shall go, Pyotr Alexandrovich. Pray go to the Father Superior, and good appetite to you. I will decline, and not you. Home, home. I'll eat at home. I don't feel equal to it here, Pyotr Alexandrovich, my amiable relative.
I'm not your relative, and never have been, you contemptible man.
I said it on purpose to madden you, because you always disclaim the relationship. Though you really are a relation in spite of your shuffling, I'll prove it by the church calendar. As for you, Ivan, stay if you like. I'll send the horses for you later.
Propriety requires you to go to the Father Superior, Pyotr Alexandrovich, to apologize for the disturbance we've been making.
Is it true that you're going home? Aren't you lying?
Pyotr Alexandrovich, how could I dare after what's happened? Forgive me, gentlemen, I was carried away and upset, besides. And indeed, I am ashamed. Gentlemen, one man has the heart of Alexander of Macedon, and another the heart of the little dog, Fido. Mine is that of the little dog, Fido. I am abashed. After such an escapade, how can I go to dinner to gobble up the monastery's sauces? I'm ashamed. I can't. You must excuse me.
The devil only knows. What if he deceives us?
Thought Miusov, still hesitating, and watching the retreating buffoon with distrustful eyes. The latter turned round and, noticing that Miusov was watching him, waved him a kiss.
Well, are you coming into the Superior?
Miusov asked Ivan abruptly.
Why not? I was specially invited yesterday. Unfortunately, I feel myself compelled to go to this confounded dinner,
said Miusov with the same irritability, regardless of the fact that the monk was listening.
We ought at least to apologize for the disturbance and explain that it was not our doing. What do you think?
Yes, we must explain that it wasn't our doing. Besides, Father won't be there, observed Ivan.
Well, I should hope not. Confound this dinner.
They all walked on, however. The monk listened in silence. On the road through the copse he made one observation, however, that the Father Superior had been waiting a long time, and that they were more than half an hour late. He received no answer. Miusov looked with hatred at Ivan.
Here he is, going to the dinner as though nothing had happened, he thought. A brazen face and the conscience of a Karamazov.
Chapter 12. And there was no murder, either.
Allow me, gentlemen of the jury, to remind you that a man's life is at stake and that you must be careful. We have heard the prosecutor himself admit that until today he hesitated to accuse the prisoner of a full and conscious premeditation of the crime. He hesitated till he saw that fatal, drunken letter which was produced in court today. All was done as written. But I repeat again, he was running to her to seek her solely to find out where she was. That's a fact that can't be disputed. Had she been at home, he would not have run away, but would have remained at her side, and so would not have done what he promised in the letter. He ran unexpectedly and accidentally, and by that time very likely he did not even remember his drunken letter. He snatched up the pestle, they say, and you will remember how a whole edifice of psychology was built on that pestle. Why, he was bound to look at that pestle as a weapon, to snatch it up, and so on, and so on. A very commonplace idea occurs to me at this point. What if that pestle had not been in sight, had not been lying on the shelf from which it was snatched by the prisoner, but had been put away in a cupboard? It would not have caught the prisoner's eye, and he would have run away without a weapon, with empty hands. And then it would certainly not have killed anyone. How then can I look upon the pestle as a proof of premeditation? Yes, but he talked in the taverns of murdering his father, and 2 days before, on the evening, when he wrote his drunken letter, he was quiet, and only quarrelled with the shopkeeper in the tavern, because the Karamazov could not help quarrelling, forsooth. But my answer to that is that if he was planning such a murder in accordance with his letter, he certainly would not have quarrelled even with the shopman, and probably would not have gone into the tavern at all, because a person plotting such a crime seeks quiet and retirement, seeks to efface himself to avoid being seen and heard, and that not from calculation, but from instinct. Gentlemen of the jury, the psychological method is a two-edged weapon, and we, too, can use it. As for all the shouting in taverns throughout the month, don't we often hear children or drunkards coming out of taverns shouting, "I'll kill you," but they don't murder anyone? And that fatal letter, isn't that simply drunken irritability, too? Isn't that simply the shout of the brawler outside the tavern, "I'll kill you, I'll kill the lot of you"? Why not? Why could it not be that? What reason have we to call that letter fatal rather than absurd? Because his father has been found murdered, because a witness saw the prisoner running out of the garden with a weapon in his hand and was knocked down by him. Therefore, we are told everything was done as he had planned in writing, and the letter was not absurd, but fatal. Now, thank God, we've come to the real point. Since he was in the garden, he must have murdered him. In those few words, "since he was, then he must," lies the whole case for the prosecution. He was there, so he must have. And what if there is no must about it, even if he was there? Oh, I admit that the chain of evidence, the coincidences, are rarely suggestive. But examine all these facts separately, regardless of their connection. Why, for instance, does the prosecution refuse to admit the truth of the prisoner's statement that he ran away from his father's window? Remember the sarcasms in which the prosecutor indulged at the expense of the respectful and pious sentiments which suddenly came over the murderer? But what if there were something of the sort, a feeling of religious awe, if not a filial respect? My mother must have been praying for me at that moment, were the prisoner's words at the preliminary inquiry, and so he ran away as soon as he convinced himself that Madame Sviatloff was not in his father's house. But he could not convince himself by looking through the window. The prosecutor objects. But why couldn't he? Why? The window opened at the signals given by the prisoner. Some word might have been uttered by Fyodor Pavlovich, some exclamation which showed the prisoner that she was not there. Why should we assume everything as we imagine it, as we made up our minds to imagine it? A thousand things may happen in reality which elude the subtlest imagination. Yes, but Grigory saw the door open, and so the prisoner certainly was in the house, therefore he killed him. Now, about that door, gentlemen of the jury. Observe that we have only the statement of one witness as to that door, and he was at the time in such a condition that... But supposing the door was open, supposing the prisoner has lied in denying it from an instinct of self-defense, natural in his position. Supposing he did go into the house, well, what then? How does it follow that because he was there, he committed the murder? He might have dashed in, run through the rooms, might have pushed his father away, might have struck him. But as soon as he'd made sure Madame Sviatloff was not there, he may have run away rejoicing that she was not there, and that he'd not killed his father. And it was perhaps just because he'd escaped from the temptation to kill his father, because he had a clear conscience and was rejoicing at not having killed him, that he was capable of a pure feeling, the feeling of pity and compassion, and leapt off the fence a minute later to the assistance of Grigory after he had, in his excitement, knocked him down. With terrible eloquence, the prosecutor has described to us the dreadful state of the prisoner's mind at Mokroe, when love again lay before him, calling him to new life. While love was impossible for him because he had his father's blood-stained corpse behind him, and beyond that corpse, retribution. And yet the prosecutor allowed him love, which he explained, according to his method, talking about his drunken condition, about a criminal being taken to execution, about it being still far off, and so on and so on. But again, I ask, Mr. Prosecutor, have you not invented a new personality? Is the prisoner so coarse and heartless as to be able to think at that moment of love and of dodges to escape punishment if his hands were really stained with his father's blood? No, no, no. As soon as it was made plain to him that she loved him and called him to her side, promising him new happiness, oh, then, I protest, he must have felt the impulse to suicide doubled, trebled, and must have killed himself if he had his father's murder on his conscience. Oh, no, he would not have forgotten where his pistols lay. I know the prisoner. The savage, stony heartlessness ascribed to him by the prosecutor is inconsistent with his character. He would have killed himself, that's certain. He did not kill himself just because his mother's prayers had saved him and he was innocent of his father's blood. He was troubled, he was grieving that night at Mokroe only about old Grigory and praying to God that the old man would recover, that his blow had not been fatal, and that he would not have to suffer for it. Why not accept such an interpretation of the facts? What trustworthy proof have we that the prisoner is lying?
But we shall be told at once again.
There is his father's corpse. If he ran away without murdering him, who did murder him? Here, I repeat, you have the whole logic of the prosecution. Who murdered him, if not he? There's no one to put in his place. Gentlemen of the jury, is that really so? Is it positively actually true that there is no one else at all? We've heard the prosecutor count on his fingers all the persons who were in that house that night. There were five in number. Three of them, I agree, could not have been responsible. The murdered man himself, old Grigory, and his wife. There are left, then, the prisoner and Smerdyakov. And the prosecutor dramatically exclaims that the prisoner pointed to Smerdyakov because he had no one else to fix on. That had there been a sixth person, even a phantom of a sixth person, he would have abandoned the charge against Smerdyakov at once, in shame, and have accused the other. But, gentlemen of the jury, why may I not draw the very opposite conclusion? There are two persons, the prisoner and Smerdyakov. Why can I not say that you accuse my client simply because you have no one else to accuse? And you have no one else only because you have determined to exclude Smerdyakov from all suspicion. It's true indeed, Smerdyakov is accused only by the prisoner, his two brothers, and Madame Sviatlov. But there are others who accuse him. There are vague rumours of a question, of a suspicion, an obscure report, a feeling of expectation. Finally, we have the evidence of a combination of facts very suggestive, though I admit inconclusive. In the first place, we have precisely on the day of the catastrophe that fit, for the genuineness of which the prosecutor for some reason has felt obliged to make a careful defence. Then, Smerdyakov's sudden suicide on the eve of the trial. Then, the equally startling evidence given in court today by the elder of the prisoner's brothers, who had believed in his guilt, but has today produced a bundle of notes and proclaimed Smerdyakov as the murderer. Oh, I fully share the court's and the prosecutor's conviction that Ivan Karamazov is suffering from brain fever, that his statement may really be a desperate effort planned in delirium to save his brother by throwing the guilt on the dead man. But again, Smerdyakov's name is pronounced. Again, there is a suggestion of mystery. There is something unexplained, incomplete. And perhaps it may one day be explained, but we won't go into that now. Of that, later. The court has resolved to go on with the trial, but meantime I might make a few remarks about the character sketch of Smerdyakov, drawn with subtlety and talent by the prosecutor. But while I admire his talent, I cannot agree with him. I have visited Smerdyakov. I have seen him and talked to him, and he made a very different impression on me. He was weak in health, it is true, but in character. In spirit, he was by no means the weak man the prosecutor has made him out to be. I found in him no trace of the timidity on which the prosecutor so insisted. There was no simplicity about him either. I found in him, on the contrary, an extreme mistrustfulness concealed under a mask of naivete and an intelligence of considerable range. The prosecutor was too simple in taking him for weak-minded. He made a very definite impression on me. I left him with the conviction that he was a distinctly spiteful creature, excessively ambitious, vindictive, and intensely envious. I made some inquiries. He resented his parentage, was ashamed of it, and would clench his teeth when he remembered that he was the son of stinking Lizaveta. He was disrespectful to the servant Grigory and his wife, who had cared for him in his childhood. He cursed and jeered at Russia. He dreamed of going to France and becoming a Frenchman. He used often to say that he hadn't the means to do so. I fancy he loved no one but himself and had a strangely high opinion of himself. His conception of culture was limited to good clothes, clean shirt fronts, and polished boots. Believing himself to be the illegitimate son of Fyodor Pavlovich, there is evidence of this. He might well have resented his position compared with that of his master's legitimate sons. They had everything, he nothing. They had all the rights, they had the inheritance, while he was only the cook. He told me himself that he had helped Fyodor Pavlovich to put the notes in the envelope. The destination of that sum, a sum which would have made his career, must have been hateful to him. Moreover, he saw 3,000 rubles in new rainbow-coloured notes. I asked him about that on purpose. Oh, beware of showing an ambitious and envious man a large sum of money at once. And it was the first time he'd seen so much money in the hands of one man. The sight of the rainbow-coloured notes may have made a morbid impression on his imagination, but with no immediate results.
The talented prosecutor, with extraordinary subtleties, sketched for us all the arguments for and against the hypothesis of Smerdyakov's guilt, and asked us in particular what motive he had in feigning a fit. But he may not have been feigning at all. The fit may have happened quite naturally, but it may have passed off quite naturally, and the sick man may have recovered, not completely perhaps, but still regaining consciousness, as happens with epileptics. The prosecutor asks at what moment could Smerdyakov have committed the murder, but it is very easy to point out that moment. He might have waked up from deep sleep, for he was only asleep. An epileptic fit is always followed by a deep sleep. At that moment, when the old Grigory shouted at the top of his voice, "Parricide!" That shout in the dark and stillness may have waked Smerdyakov, whose sleep may have been less sound at the moment. He might naturally have waked up an hour before. Getting out of bed, he goes almost unconsciously and with no definite motive toward the sound to see what's the matter. His head is still clouded with his attack, his faculties are half asleep, but once in the garden he walks to the lighted window and he hears terrible news from his master, who would be, of course, glad to see him. His mind sets to work at once. He hears all the details from his frightened master, and gradually, in his disordered brain, there shapes itself an idea, terrible, but seductive and irresistibly logical. To kill the old man, take the 3,000, and throw all the blame onto his young master. A terrible lust of money, of booty, might seize upon him as he realized his security from detection. Oh, these sudden and irresistible impulses come so often when there is a favorable opportunity, and especially with murderers who have had no idea of committing a murder beforehand. And Smerdyakov may have gone in and carried out his plan. With what weapon? Why? With any stone picked up in the garden. But what for? With what object? Why, the 3,000, which means a career for him. Oh, I'm not contradicting myself. The money may have existed. And perhaps Smerdyakov alone knew where to find it, where his master kept it, and the covering of the money, the torn envelope on the floor. Just now, when the prosecutor was explaining his subtle theory that only an inexperienced thief like Karamazov would have left the envelope on the floor, and not one like Smerdyakov, who would have avoided leaving a piece of evidence against himself, I thought as I listened that I was hearing something very familiar. And would you believe it, I have heard that very argument, that very conjecture of how Karamazov would have behaved, precisely 2 days before, from Smerdyakov himself. What's more, it struck me at the time. I fancied that there was an artificial simplicity about him, that he was in a hurry to suggest this idea to me, that I might fancy it was my own. He insinuated it, as it were. Did he not insinuate the same idea at the inquiry and suggest it to the talented prosecutor? I shall be asked, what about the old woman, Grigory's wife? She heard the sick man moaning close by all night. Yes, she heard it, but that evidence is extremely unreliable. I knew a lady who complained bitterly that she'd been kept awake all night by a dog in the yard. Yet the poor beast, it appeared, had only yelped once or twice in the night, and that's natural. If anyone is asleep and hears a groan, he wakes up annoyed at being waked, but instantly falls asleep again. 2 hours later, again a groan, he wakes up and falls asleep again, and the same thing again, 2 hours later, 3 times altogether in the night. Next morning the sleeper wakes up and complains that someone's been groaning all night and keeping him awake. And it is bound to seem so to him. The intervals of 2 hours of sleep he does not remember. He only remembers the moments of waking. So he feels he's been waked up all night. But why, asked the prosecutor, did not Smerdyakov confess in his last letter? Why did his conscience prompt him to one step and not to both? But excuse me, conscience implies penitence, and the suicide may not have felt penitence, but only despair. Despair and penitence are two very different things. Despair may be vindictive and irreconcilable, and the suicide, laying his hands on himself, may well have felt redoubled hatred for those whom he'd envied all his life. Gentlemen of the jury, beware of a miscarriage of justice. What is there unlikely in all I have put before you just now? Find the error in my reasoning. Find the impossibility, the absurdity. And if there is but a shade of possibility, but a shade of probability in my propositions, do not condemn him. And is there only a shade? I swear by all that is sacred, I fully believe in the explanation of the murder I have just put forward. What troubles me and makes me indignant is that of all the mass of facts heaped up by the prosecution against the prisoner,
There is not a single one certain and irrefutable. And yet the unhappy man is to be ruined by the accumulation of these facts. Yes, the accumulated effort is awful. The blood dripping from his fingers, the blood-stained shirt, the dark night resounding with the shout parricide, and the old man falling with a broken head. And then the mass of phrases, statements, gestures, shouts. Oh, this has so much influence, it can so bias the mind. But, gentlemen of the jury, can it bias your minds? Remember, you have been given absolute power to bind and to loose. But the greater the power, the more terrible its responsibility. I do not draw back one iota from what I have said just now. But suppose for one moment I agreed with the prosecution that my luckless client had stained his hands with his father's blood. This is only an hypothesis, I repeat. I never for one instant doubt of his innocence. But so be it, I assume that my client is guilty of parricide. Even so, hear what I have to say. I have it in my heart to say something more to you, for I feel that there must be a great conflict in your hearts and minds. Forgive my referring to your hearts and minds, gentlemen of the jury, but I want to be truthful and sincere to the end. Let us all be sincere. At this point, the speech was interrupted by rather loud applause. The last words, indeed, were pronounced with a note of such sincerity that everyone felt that he really might have something to say, and that what he was about to say would be of the greatest consequence. But the president, hearing the applause, in a loud voice threatened to clear the court if such an incident were repeated. Every sound was hushed, and Fedyukovitch began in a voice full of feeling, quite unlike the tone he had used hitherto. Chapter 13. A Corrupter of Thought. "It's not the only accumulation of facts that threatens my client with ruin, gentlemen of the jury," he began. "What is really damning for my client is one fact, the dead body of his father. Had it been an ordinary case of murder, you would have rejected the charge in view of the triviality, the incompleteness, and the fantastic character of the evidence, if you examine each part of it separately. Or, at least, you would have hesitated to ruin a man's life simply from the prejudice against him which he has, alas, only too well deserved. But it's not an ordinary case of murder, it's a case of parricide. That impresses men's minds, and to such a degree that the very triviality and incompleteness of the evidence becomes less trivial and less incomplete, even to an unprejudiced mind. How can such a prisoner be acquitted? What if he committed the murder and gets off unpunished? That is what everyone almost involuntarily, instinctively feels at heart. Yes, it's a fearful thing to shed a father's blood. The father who has begotten me, loved me, not spared his life for me, grieved over my illnesses from childhood up, troubled all his life for my happiness, and has lived in my joys, in my successes. To murder such a father, that's inconceivable. Gentlemen of the jury, what is a father? A real father? What is the meaning of that great word? What is the great idea in that name? We have just indicated in part what a true father is and what he ought to be. In the case in which we are now so deeply occupied and over which our hearts are aching, in the present case, the father, Fyodor Pavlovich Karamazov, did not correspond to that conception of a father to which we have just referred. That's the misfortune. And indeed some fathers are a misfortune. Let us examine this misfortune rather more closely. We must shrink from nothing, gentlemen of the jury, considering the importance of the decision you have to make. It's our particular duty not to shrink from any idea, like children or frightened women, as the talented prosecutor happily expresses it. But in the course of his heated speech, my esteemed opponent, and he was my opponent before I opened my lips, exclaimed several times, "Oh, I will not yield the defense of the prisoner to the lawyer who has come down from Petersburg. I accuse, but I defend also." He exclaimed that several times, but forgot to mention that if this terrible prisoner was for 23 years so grateful for a mere pound of nuts given him by the only man who had been kind to him as a child in his father's house, might not such a man well have remembered for 23 years how he ran in his father's backyard, without boots on his feet and with his little trousers hanging by one button,
to use the expression of the kind-hearted Dr. Herzenstube. Oh, gentlemen of the jury, why need we look more closely at this misfortune? Why repeat what we all know already? What did my client meet with when he arrived here at his father's house? And why depict my client as a heartless egoist and monster? He is uncontrolled, he is wild and unruly. We are trying him now for that. But who is responsible for his life? Who is responsible for his having received such an unseemly bringing up in spite of his excellent disposition and his grateful and sensitive heart? Did anyone train him to be reasonable? Was he enlightened by study? Did anyone love him ever so little in his childhood? My client was left to the care of Providence like a beast of the field. He thirsted, perhaps, to see his father after long years of separation. 1,000 times, perhaps, he may, recalling his childhood, have driven away the loathsome phantoms that haunted his childish dreams, and with all his heart he may have longed to embrace and to forgive his father. And what awaited him? He was met by cynical taunts, suspicions, and wrangling about money. He heard nothing but revolting talk and vicious precepts uttered daily over the brandy. And at last he saw his father seducing his mistress from him with his own money. Oh, gentlemen of the jury, that was cruel and revolting, and that old man was always complaining of the disrespect and cruelty of his son. He slandered him in society, injured him, calumniated him, bought up his unpaid debts to get him thrown into prison. Gentlemen of the jury, people like my client, who are fierce, unruly, and uncontrolled on the surface, are sometimes, most frequently indeed, exceedingly tender-hearted, only they don't express it. Don't laugh at my idea. The talented prosecutor laughed mercilessly just now at my client loving Schiller, loving the sublime and beautiful. I should not have laughed at that in his place. Yes, such natures, oh, let me speak in defense of such natures, so often and so cruelly misunderstood. These natures often thirst for tenderness, goodness, and justice, as it were, in contrast to themselves, their unruliness, their ferocity. They thirst for it unconsciously. Passionate and fierce on the surface, they are painfully capable of loving woman, for instance, and with a spiritual and elevated love. Again, do not laugh at me. This is very often the case in such natures. But they cannot hide their passions, sometimes very coarse, and that is conspicuous and is noticed, but the inner man is unseen. Their passions are quickly exhausted, but by the side of a noble and lofty creature, that seemingly coarse and rough man seeks a new life, seeks to correct himself, to be better, to become noble and honorable, sublime and beautiful, however much the expression has been ridiculed. I said just now that I would not venture to touch upon my client's engagement, but I may say half a word. What we heard just now was not evidence, but only the scream of a frenzied and revengeful woman, and it was not for her, oh, not for her, to reproach him with treachery. For she has betrayed him. If she had had but a little time for reflection, she would have not given such evidence. Oh, do not believe her. No, my client is not a monster, as she called him. The lover of mankind on the eve of his crucifixion said, I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for his sheep so that not one of them might be lost. Let not a man's soul be lost through us. I asked just now, what does father mean, and exclaimed that it was a great word, a precious name, but one must use words honestly, gentlemen. And I venture to call things by their right names. Such a father as old Karamazov cannot be called a father, and does not deserve to be. Filial love for an unworthy father is an absurdity, an impossibility. Love cannot be created from nothing. Only God can create something from nothing. Fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, the apostle writes. From a heart glowing with love, it's not for the sake of my client that I quote these sacred words. I mention them for all fathers. Who has authorized me to preach to fathers? No one, but as a man and a citizen, I make my appeal. Vivos voco. We are not long on earth. We do many evil deeds and say many evil words, so let us all catch a favorable moment when we all are together to say a good word to each other. That's what I'm doing. While I'm in this place, I take advantage of my opportunity. Not for nothing is this tribune given us by the highest authority. All Russia hears us. I am not speaking only for the fathers here present. I cry aloud to all fathers. Fathers, provoke not your children to wrath. Yes, let us first fulfill Christ's injunction ourselves, and only then venture to expect it of our children. Otherwise we are not fathers, but enemies of our children, and they are not our children, but our enemies, and we have made them our enemies ourselves. What measure you mete it shall be measured unto you again. It's not I who say that, it's the gospel precept. Measure to others according as they measure to you. How can we blame children if they measure us according to our measure? Not long ago, a servant girl in Finland was suspected of having secretly given birth to a child. She was watched, and a box, of which no one knew anything, was found in the corner of the loft behind some bricks. It was opened, and inside was found the body of a newborn child which she had killed. In the same box were found the skeletons of two other babies, which, according to her own confession, she had killed at the moment of their birth. Gentlemen of the jury, was she a mother to her children? She gave birth to them indeed, but was she a mother to them? Would anyone venture to give her the sacred name of mother? Let us be bold, gentlemen, let us be audacious even. It's our duty to be so at this moment and not to be afraid of certain words and ideas like the Moscow women in Ostrovsky's play who are scared at the sound of certain words. No, let us prove that the progress of the last few years has touched even us, and let us say plainly the father is not merely he who begets the child, but he who begets it and does his duty by it. Oh, of course there is the other meaning, there is the other interpretation of the word father, which insists that any father, even though he be a monster, even though he be the enemy of his children, still remains my father simply because he begot me. But this is, so to say, the mystical meaning which I cannot comprehend with my intellect, but can only accept by faith, or better to say, on faith. Like many other things which I do not understand, but which religion bids me believe. But in that case, let it be kept outside the sphere of actual life. In the sphere of actual life, which has, indeed, its own rights, but also lays upon us great duties and obligations in that sphere, if we want to be humane. Christian, in fact, we must or ought to act only upon convictions justified by reason and experience, which have been passed through the crucible of analysis. In a word, we must act rationally and not as though in dreams and delirium, that we may not do harm, that we may not ill-treat and ruin a man. Then it will be real Christian work, not only mystic, but rational and philanthropic. There was violent applause at this passage from many parts of the court, but Fetyukovich waved his hands as though imploring them to let him finish without interruption. The court relapsed into silence at once. The orator went on. Do you suppose, gentlemen, that our children, as they grow up and begin to reason, can avoid such questions? No, they cannot. And we will not impose on them an impossible restriction. The sight of an unworthy father involuntarily suggests tormenting questions to a young creature, especially when he compares him with the excellent fathers of his companions. The conventional answer to this question is, he begot you, and you are his flesh and blood, and therefore you are bound to love him. The youth involuntarily reflects, but did he love me when he begot me? He asks, wondering more and more, was it for my sake he begot me? He did not know me, nor even my sex, at that moment, at the moment of passion, perhaps inflamed by wine. And he has only transmitted to me a propensity to drunkenness that all he's done for me. Why am I bound to love him simply for begetting me when he's cared nothing for me all my life after? Oh, perhaps these questions strike you as coarse and cruel, but do not expect an impossible restraint from a young mind. Drive nature out of the door, and it will fly in at the window. And above all, let us not be afraid of words, but decide the question according to the dictates of reason and humanity, and not of mystic ideas. How shall it be decided? Why, like this. Let the son stand before his father and ask him, Father, tell me, why must I love you? Father, show me that I must love you.
and if that father is able to answer him and show him good reason, we have a real, normal parental relation, not resting on mystical prejudice, but on a rational, responsible, and strictly humanitarian basis. But if he does not, there's an end to the family tie. He is not a father to him, and the son has a right to look upon him as a stranger and even an enemy. Our tribune, gentlemen of the jury, ought to be a school of true and sound ideas. Here the orator was interrupted by irrepressible and almost frantic applause. Of course, it was not the whole audience, but a good half